I'm going to campus. If those petty fuckers think I'm in hiding, they'll start circling like wolves. They need to know that I have every intention of fighting back if they try to get rid of me.
I suggest that he find a way to remind the dean that at least three of Jason's senior colleagues were married to former students. Anything scheduled, or do you think you might be able to come home early? The pause that followed felt long, but could have been completely imagined, like what I perceived as a quick glance at the cell phone that had buzzed minutes earlier. He popped a piece of Nicorette from his nightstand into his mouth.
Just a lunch meeting with someone from Oasis.
The name sounded familiar, but he could tell from my blank expression that I was having trouble filling in the details.
The world needs water,
he said as a prompt. Their slogan. Jason's early academic scholarship applied principles of moral philosophy to corporate governance practices. I made a habit of reading his articles, but had a hard time understanding them. The book that made him famous was a pop version of his ivory tower work, weaving together liberal politics, corporate scandals, and stories across history and cultures to demonstrate a correlation between economic health and equal treatment of citizens. His consulting group, FSS, was an outgrowth of his academic work. In theory, he was an advisor to corporations, teaching them how to maximize profits by following guiding principles of morality and equality. But he also paired corporate clients with financial clients, essentially endorsing private, for-profit entities to investors who supported his theories. As I understood it, Oasis specialized in bringing clean water to different parts of the world. A few months earlier, Jason had been working nearly full-time counseling and finding financing for Oasis, until something happened to give him pause. Is the meeting about that problem you mentioned? I asked.
Did I mention that?
Well, not in detail. He looked up from the belt he was buckling.
You're actually interested?
Of course. He sat on the edge of the bed.
They may not be as kosher as everyone thinks.
Well, that's not good. Water sort of needs to be clean.
Yeah, but it's not the water itself that's the problem. Oasis is a major up-and-comer on the CSR list because of the substance of what they do, treating and transporting water. They're on the cutting edge of developing systems for global water security, basically making sure the entire world has access. It's truly transformative stuff. But, as usual, too many of the CSR gatekeepers are idiots.
I was following so far. The CSR lists ranked companies based on their corporate social responsibility. Jason's book and podcast had brought those lists into the mainstream, exposing the general public to their existence, but also demonstrating how companies can manipulate the CSR rankings for marketing purposes. A retailer, for example, might tout its green operations, reusable bags, organic foods, energy-saving operations, while capping employee hours to avoid paying for health benefits. Jason has made a name for himself by publicly shaming several Fortune 500 companies and the so-called analysts who supported them without due diligence. Jason's stamp of approval was now the gold star of the CSR world. His consulting company helped companies develop CSR policies and paired worthwhile firms with major financial backers. So what did the others miss? I asked.
The technology itself is worth nothing if it's not implemented where it's needed most, he said. Getting clean water to Arizona is great, but getting it into farms and villages in remote parts of the world is the game changer. Needless to say, the potential for corruption in that process is huge.
And you found corruption? He raised his eyebrows.
I'm not sure, but yeah, I think so. The books don't look right. Inconsistent payments to local vendors that don't line up to actual work or equipment. It reeks of massive kickbacks, basically bribing the power brokers to get into the territory.
Is that really all that bad if it means the locals get water?
Except my entire life's work is about not making those kind of compromises. We don't pollute the planet to create jobs or use slave labor to bring the internet to developing nations. Sorry, I'm ranting. In this particular case, it's not only the usual trade-offs. Given the region I'm talking about, that money might have gone to terrorists and warlords.
Jason was more animated than I'd seen him in days. So what are you going to do about it?
I don't know. I can't prove my suspicions, but I also can't turn a blind eye. Basically, I've got a conflict of interest. Oasis is my client, but so are the investors I pair them with. Plus, there's my own reputation.
Your brand, I added with air quotes, because I knew how much the word irked him.
Precisely. And most importantly, at the end of the day, I need to be able to look at myself in the mirror and believe I've done the right thing.
So, yeah, if anything's weighing on me, it's been this clusterfuck, not the nonsense with what's-her-name. Rachel Sutton, I said to myself. She had a name. I'm hoping the lunch meeting I'm having today might help. I've been trying for a month and a half to get one of my contacts at Oasis to come clean and do the right thing. I told him that I was sorry he had so much on his plate at one time.
Don't be sorry. I'm the one who decided to take all this on. You, of all people, warned me.
He kissed me on the head. You smell so good. He kissed me one more time on the cheek and stood up.
I'll try to be back home by the time Spencer gets out of school. Maybe we can pick him up together or stop at Agata on the way home for lamb chops.
Sounds great. I picture the two of us standing outside Spencer's school, holding hands in front of all the gossipy moms. He had a point about going face to face with the circling wolves. He had his pack. I had mine. When I heard the front door close, I tapped the top of my iPad screen and typed in Oasis Water Carrie. Within a few clicks, I confirmed that the vice president of marketing for Oasis Inc. was a woman named Carrie Lynch. That was my husband's lunch meeting, exactly as he had told me. I felt silly for checking. 14. Spencer was already scrambling eggs in the kitchen when I walked downstairs. He had two small plates on the counter, plus a jar of salsa. I remember the first time I realized that my son was a stronger person than I'd ever been. He was in half-day kindergarten. I'd mistimed the baking of a batch of mini quiches for a client's cocktail party and couldn't leave. Mom was cleaning a house. As I had way too many times, I asked Dad if he could pick Spencer up from school. His legs were killing him by then, and he moved so slow. He showed up probably 7 minutes after I would have. When the two of them returned, Spencer tossed his backpack on the kitchen table, declared that he was ready for taste-testing duty, and then rated my latest creations 5-star nosh. He disappeared to our room, the one we still shared at my parents' house, the one I had grown up in, as if everything were normal. Dad broke the news. When he pulled up in front of the school, he saw Spencer on the ground, two boys standing over him. He managed to get out of his car in time to hear the gist of the boys' comments. Why did he have the same last name as the one his mom grew up with? Why didn't he have a dad? Everyone knows your mom ran away and came back with a bastard baby. The boys took off when they saw my father headed their way.
I thought you should know, Dad told me. I still think we made the right decision, but it's always up to you. Oh, and for what it's worth, I recognize the biggest kid is Tony Faulkner's boy. I'm half tempted to drive to that hellhole of a house and have a word with him.
That's a bad idea, Dad. Dad shook his head, but said nothing else. The hellhole in question was a multi-acre lot off Three Mile Harbor, where multiple generations of Faulkners resided. The Faulkner family was despised throughout the East End, but the topic of their family was especially touchy in our house. Mom and Dad still believe that my entire life might have been different if it hadn't been for my association with that girl, as they referred to Tricia. Tony Faulkner was Tricia's youngest uncle, which would make the kid bullying Spencer her cousin. Based on what I knew about the things Faulkner men did to children, it did not surprise me at all that his son would have already be screwed up. When I asked Spencer about it that night, he shrugged and insisted it was no big deal. If you want to tell other kids where you were born and why your last name is Mullen, you can. Against my mother's wishes, I had told Spencer the truth about the circumstances of his birth the first time he asked me, on his 5th birthday. I also told him that my parents had made the decision for me at the time not to share the details with anyone. All they said to those brave enough to ask was that I was back home and they were overjoyed to have their baby grandson, Spencer, at the house too. Filling in the blanks, most people assumed I had run away, gotten pregnant, and then come home again. It was a way to protect my privacy, to let me start over without people asking me about what happened for the rest of my life. But none of us had stopped to think about how it would eventually affect Spencer. At the time, I was the child who needed protecting. Spencer was just an extension of me.
They only went after me because of Luis, Spencer said.
Who's Luis?
He's a Mexican kid in our class. They were telling him that his parents work for free and that they're taking jobs from all the people who were born here and that they don't speak English right and stuff. So when I was captain of the kickball team, I picked Luis first and refused to pick any of them. It matters a lot when you get picked. My 6-year-old son, after everything he had been through, had stuck up for another kid. Besides, he added, it's not their beeswax. He sounded exactly like my mother. True, but it's yours. I didn't want you to think that you have to keep a secret or tell a lie. All I ask is that if you tell anyone, make sure that I know too, okay? I'd been home for 5 years by then, and in that time I had told only one person where I'd been those years, and that was Susanna. If Spencer's decisions were going to change that, I needed to be prepared. It's not a secret or a lie, Spencer said. It's not anything because I don't remember not living here. And I don't care where the other half of me came from. I'm a Mullen. I'm from you and Grandma and Granddaddy. He added with a smile. And I was about to kick those kids' asses before Granddaddy saved them. 7 years later, as he carried a plate of eggs and the jar of salsa to the table, Spencer looked over my shoulder and caught me reading a website called Rate My Professor on my iPad, where there's a chili pepper next to my husband's name, indicating hotness. Spencer had to know why I was looking. It was now day two, and the Post had a follow-up story. With nothing new to report, they ran a Who is Jason Powell piece, complete with quotes from online student reviews. Distractingly smoking. Seems like he might be gettable. Sexy AF. I'd let him teach me anything he wants. We've all read this book and seen this movie before. A potentially great man struck down by the lingering shadows of a scandal. Would-be presidents tarnished by extramarital affairs, celebrities unable to find work after tape recordings emerge of their most hateful comments, businesses boycotted for being on the wrong side of the cultural tide. I imagined Jason floating beside the other castaways. I pictured unsold copies of his book being returned to the warehouse, the loss of clients at his consulting company, and the university trying to strip him of tenure. What would happen to Spencer and me? What would everyone say about us? But if Spencer was worried, he wasn't letting on. Dad's innocent, he said. Everyone else will realize that soon enough, and then everything will go back to normal. There was not a shade of doubt in his voice. I squeezed his hand and said, I know. Then waited until he left for school to continue reading. I was alone when I heard a knock at the door an hour later. I looked through the peephole to see my mother glaring at our hideous brass knocker, the one I called the vomiting gargoyle. The one I'd meant to replace since we first closed on the house 3 years earlier. It took me a second to process that she was actually there, standing on my stoop. Ginny Mullen does not show up on doorsteps in Greenwich Village. I could count on one hand the number of times she had visited me in the city. Though they weren't officially related to any of the original Boniker families of the 17th century, she and my father were born and bred islanders, with at least 4 generations settled in the Springs on both sides. But where their great-grandfathers were able to work with pride as fishermen and farmers, my parents worked service jobs, handyman for Dad, housework for Mom, for wealthy summer vacationers, in the hopes of squirreling away enough money to make it through the rest of the year. My mother associated the city with the people who treated her as something less than human. She famously declined the opportunity to accompany my 6th-grade class to a Christmas show at Radio City Music Hall, explaining that all of New York City smelled of sweat, urine, garbage, and dirty money. When I told her I was marrying Jason, she told me, in this order, that she was happy for me, that Jason was a good man, and that you better know I let my grandson turn into a little asshole. As I untumbled all the locks, I had no doubt that her sudden appearance in the city was directly connected to the unreturned messages she had left on my phone since Jason became viral fodder the previous morning. Hey, Mom, I said as I swung the door open. What are you doing here? Did you take the train? She was in the foyer before I finished my questions. No, I had Jeeves, the butler, hire a goddamn limousine. Why did you come all the way into the city? Oh, please, Angela, you're not the center of the universe. I have an appointment, a specialist. Figured I should at least stop by and see my daughter while they're ripping off my Obamacare. For a second, I wasn't sure what to believe. Was she lying about the doctor's appointment to check on me, or had she been calling about a health problem only to have her child ignore her calls? What kind of specialist? What's wrong? I'm old, she said, the words themselves serving as a shrug. I took her response as confirmation that nothing serious was wrong with her health. She was only 65 and had never referred to herself as old until my father died 5 years ago.
The medical appointment was either fabricated or minor.
I take it you heard about the incident with Jason and his student?
I led the way into the kitchen and popped an espresso pot into the machine, waiting for her to mock the absence of a real pot of coffee.
So, did he do it?
Of course not, Mom. He made an innocent comment about her being too young to get married. She took it to be a pass, and then everything got exaggerated.
Mom took the tiny cup of caffeine from me, complete with an eye roll, then made her way to the refrigerator for a dash of the whole milk I keep around for Spencer.
Even innocent comments can be loaded, she said. In my day, it was called innuendo.
I did not want to think about my mother engaging in what she considered to be innuendo, but without prompting, she did me the honor of an impromptu performance.
You're much too young to become a bride, she said in a masculine voice.
You might be right, Dr. Powell, she said in a ridiculous femme fatale delivery. Why don't you show me what I'll be missing?
And scene. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Tip your servers. We'll be here all night.
Angela, you're smarter than this. I have no doubt it was a misunderstanding, but misunderstandings don't happen when a situation is black and white. They only happen when there were shades of gray, when there could be two different versions of the same damn thing.
What did Jason do with that girl?
Nothing, Mom. Nothing happened. She took a sip of the coffee that, from the look on her face, still wasn't to her liking.
Are the two of you okay?
Mom, please. A man his age has certain needs. I know you don't like to talk about it.
Jesus, Mom, I am not having this conversation with you. Jason and I are fine. I can't believe you were blaming this on me. Do not make this about me.
By the time she reached for me, my hand was trembling as I slammed a fresh purple pod into the Nespresso machine.
You can always come home if it's too much. He's already been pushing you to the brink.
Other women would be proud of Jason's accomplishments, but my mother knew that as much as I didn't want to be yet another cog in the East End service culture, I never wanted a spotlight either.
I don't need to come home, Mom.
Colin hired a lawyer for Jason and says everything's going to be fine.
Maybe so, but that's why I'm here, okay? You need to take care of yourself and Spencer. The two of you come first. If Jason made this mess, he can deal with it on his own. I've seen how these people blame everything on anyone else.
We spent the next 20 minutes arguing about whether Jason could be clumped in with these people, during which she invoked several examples of what she perceived to be Jason's sense of entitlement. When I couldn't take it any longer, I asked her whether she had a doctor's appointment or not.
Yes, I have an appointment, like I said.
Is it something serious? Can I come with you?
She carried her ridiculously tiny Nespresso cup to the sink, rinsed it out, and rested it on a dish towel on the counter. When she turned around, her broad, flat face was filled with a smile.
My appointment is for a manicure, and you are coming with me. And Jason's gonna pay.
Well, that sounds absolutely lovely.
I'm serious, Angela. If he fucked up, he really does need to pay.
I told her once again that everything was gonna be fine. She didn't look convinced, but stopped pressing the point for the time being.
Look on the bright side. The last thing you wanted was him running for office. Doesn't seem like you'll be needing to worry about that anymore.
I shook my head and smiled, but part of me realized she had a point. Assuming this crisis passed, Jason would have a good reason to stay out of the public eye for a long, long time. 15. The woman was probably in her mid-30s, with straight, shoulder-length, dark hair and full lips. Dressed elegantly in a simple, long-sleeved navy dress and heels, she glanced around nervously, as if she knew how out of place she looked. Corinne rose to shake her hand and gestured toward the chair next to her desk.
You're the detective in charge?
A civilian clerk had helped the woman find her way to Corinne when she showed up at SVU, asking about Jason Powell.
Are you still investigating the case with the intern?
I can't comment on that. I'm sorry. Do you know something?
The woman shook her head.
So, how can I help you?
Corinne asked. The woman looked down at her hands folded on her crossed legs, obviously contemplating something. When she finally spoke, she looked up to make eye contact.
6 weeks ago, he raped me, and I did nothing. Today he came to my house and offered to pay me $100,000 if I promised not to say anything. I assume he's afraid I'll come forward now that someone else has.
Okay, let's go talk in private.
I'm Detective Duncan, but you can call me Corinne.
I'm Carrie,
Carrie Lynch. Part 2. Carrie. 16. Jason's attorney worked fast. Within 30 hours of her leaving our house, a left-wing gossip site ran the photo I found of Rachel Sutton kissing her fellow graduate student and intern, Wilson Stewart. Beneath it was the picture she had posted days later showing off her engagement ring. The website had blurred her face, but the comments that followed repeatedly mentioned her full name, now easily searchable online. By that evening, an entirely different narrative emerged. One website ran a quote from Rachel's fiancé saying that he was hurt and confused when he saw the picture of Rachel and Wilson together. More helpfully to Jason, the fiancé told a reporter that Rachel had never mentioned her complaint against Jason, and that she only called him about it after the news went viral. When asked whether the couple was still engaged, the fiancé said, "I doubt it." The fiancé wasn't the only man distancing himself from Rachel. The following morning, Wilson appeared on New Day with none other than Susanna Coleman to confirm that he had a brief and casual relationship with a fellow intern, still officially unnamed, that developed after a night of drinking on the rooftop bar at the Standard Hotel. "She told me the first night we hooked up that she thought Jason, Dr. Powell, I mean, was sort of hot. I got the impression that she was into him, a lot of the students are. But he lets it be known that he's happily married." Making every attempt to appear objective, Susanna asked Wilson, "But to be clear, you can't say for certain what happened that day in Dr. Powell's office, correct?" "I didn't see it with my own eyes, but I've never known Jason Powell to be anything but a professional, inspiring mentor. As for the complainant, she's sweet, but she can be dramatic and sort of hypersensitive. She has a tendency to blow things out of proportion, so..." The trail of his thought was the perfect moment for Susanna to thank Wilson for his time and cut to a commercial. The message was clear. Don't believe a word she says. An hour after Susanna's interview with Wilson, my cell phone rang. It was from the 631 area code. Suffolk County. I hated that area code. "Hello?
Is, this Angela?"
"Who's calling?"
This is Steve Hendricks."
His first name sounded weird. Years ago, when he was part of my regular vocabulary, we called him Hendricks, or the detective. I didn't say anything.
I saw the news about your husband. I don't know how I can help, but if I can."
I hung up, then hit block this caller for good measure. When Jason and I were in bed that night, I asked him if Olivia had questioned his intern, Wilson, about whether he had ever mentioned those boxer shorts to Rachel.
"She decided it was better not to reveal that detail, since it's not public yet."
"But shouldn't we find that out?" As things stood, that photograph of her kissing Wilson had been used to make her look promiscuous, and not for any other reason.
"I think Olivia preferred Wilson's statement as it was, especially that part about my being hot."
"Sort of hot," I corrected. "I don't understand why she wouldn't have at least asked him about it in private."
"Because that would be giving him information he doesn't currently have."
"Would that be so bad? I mean, Rachel could have seen something. You said you were tucking your shirt in when she walked in."
"But the police don't know that. She made it sound like I was flashing her or something."
"But maybe she did see more than you thought?" He rested the book he was reading on his chest and looked at me directly.
"I'm just glad this looks like it's over. Aren't you?"
"Of course I am."
"Okay, then."
He kissed me and kept reading. As I closed my eyes, I wondered where Rachel Sutton was and how she was feeling. 17. Corinne was waiting at the counter for her lunch when ADA Brian King's number appeared on her cell. "Duncan," she said.
"So, did you watch it?"
He had called her yesterday to see if she had seen a kid named Wilson Stewart on New Day. Apparently, he was one of Jason Powell's interns and had had a fling with Rachel Sutton. Corinne had informed him that she had an actual job that kept her from watching morning television, but she'd find it online when she had time. Now that she had watched it, she told King that she didn't think it changed anything. "You said from the start the case was impossible, plus it's a misdemeanor at best. Carrie's case is the one that matters now, right?" The media winds had shifted in Jason Powell's direction in the last 2 days, but Carrie Lynch would prove harder to discredit. She was the vice president of marketing for Oasis, Inc., one of Powell's clients. According to Carrie, Powell was flirtatious during the course of their work together. When he walked her back to her hotel room after a business dinner 6 weeks ago, he made an advance. When she rejected him, he suddenly grabbed her, threw her down on the bed, and bound her wrist together with his belt. For King, it wasn't enough.
I said Rachel's case was impossible to prove on its own. I want to put these two charges together and argue that it's part of a pattern.
And you can still do that. Carrie may not have called the police immediately, but she did take photographs of the red marks on her wrists. She also had the presence of mind to hold on to the DNA, placing the skirt and panties she'd been wearing during the attack in a plastic hotel laundry bag. She had handed Corinne the bag as if it contained hazardous materials. Well, you'll see. It's on there. I was so sick afterward I started to throw it away, but I didn't want the maids to see. This bag has been stuffed in the corner of my closet ever since. Maybe some part of me knew I should hang on to it. On the other end of the line, King was still venting about yesterday's New Day interview.
I'll bet you $1,000 that Powell gets that kid whatever hedge fund job he wants when he graduates.
Behind the counter, a guy with arms the size of milk gallons called out Corinne's name and handed her a takeout bag, already beginning to spot with grease.
Where are you?
King asked.
Getting lunch.
Where?
La Chonera, la Isla.
I don't even know what you just said.
Best chicharrón in the city.
Okay, you're making up words now.
I like how you own your whiteness, King. It suits you.
At the register, she fished $12 from her purse, enough to cover lunch and a healthy tip for the jar. She continued the conversation outside as she began the short walk back to the precinct.
Do you have a subpoena yet for the hotel?
Powell had attacked Carrie after walking her back to her room at the W. Surveillance video wouldn't show the actual assault, but the footage might at least place Powell inside a hotel room with the complainant.
Yeah, I sent it over to their general counsel this morning. I'll email you the contact info so you can follow up. I also subpoenaed his cell phone records.
Sounds good. And, oh, the preliminary screening of the clothes Carrie gave me confirmed the presence of semen. We need a warrant to swab Powell.
A quick oral swab would give them the DNA they needed for a comparison.
I don't know. The case is weak. She ain't reported until 6 weeks later, King said.
Corinne did her best to keep her voice calm as she tried to explain the flaw in his logic.
The whole reason you leaked Rachel's complaint in the first place was to see if other victims, ones who never came forward, might contact us. You were looking for a pattern. Bill Cosby, Trump, that gym teacher last year in Queens. Men who do this once do it often. But now, after that worked and led us to Carrie, you're holding it against her that she didn't come forward earlier?
I want the case to be better.
Most rape survivors don't call the police, and Carrie has a good explanation. She knew how important Powell's work was for her company, and she didn't think anyone would believe her, given his squeaky clean image.
You don't need to give me the sex offenses 101 lecture, Duncan. But I'm the one who needs to convince the jury. And it doesn't matter how the real world works. In court, jurors don't like victims who wait almost 2 months to call the police. Not to mention, she met with Powell in person at her house the same day she accused him of rape.
According to Carrie, Jason had insisted on meeting with her alone after Rachel's complaint against him hit the news. Carrie agreed to meet him at her home because she did not want her co-workers to overhear whatever he had to say. He offered her $100,000 to sign a non-disclosure agreement regarding the attack at the hotel. She told him that she wanted to think about it, but went to SVU instead.
I'm not asking you to go to trial yet. We just need the DNA swab.
Except judges aren't immune to media attention. They'll want to know his side of the story.
He already lawyered up.
That was about Rachel, not Carrie.
Well, if he invoked about a misdemeanor, he's gonna invoke on a rape charge.
We won't know until we ask. At the very least, the judge will see we did some legwork before asking for a swab. Maybe you can word your questions as if they're related to Rachel. Well, by now, he probably thinks he's in the clear on that.
But he invoked as to Rachel, Corinne argued. I'm only allowed to speak to him because there's a new allegation.
Let me do the lawyering, okay? You're now required to notify him of the new charge. Tell him Carrie Lynch's name came up in your investigation, something low-key like that. Let's see how he responds.
Now you're telling me how to do my job?
Fair enough. Enjoy your chimichangas or whatever.
Enjoy your turkey sandwich on whole grain.
Please tell me that was a lucky guess.
Uh-huh, she said, smiling as she hung up.
18. As each hour passed, I could almost feel the rest of the world caring less and less about Jason and whatever it was that intern may have said about him. Jason's attorney hadn't gotten an official assurance that he wouldn't be charged criminally, but she said that wasn't unusual. You either got charged or you didn't. Rachel had stopped coming to work, as one would expect, but it had been 3 days since the news broke, and she hadn't filed a formal complaint with the university or done anything else to pursue the matter. The three remaining interns, including Wilson Stewart, told Zach that they assumed Rachel was embarrassed that her complaint had spiraled so out of control. The dean had not asked for any further meetings with Jason after their initial conversation about the police report. Jason hadn't lost any clients. He'd even managed to record an episode of his podcast without mentioning the scandal. By the time I finished cleaning up after dinner, it actually felt like the incident might be in our rearview mirror. In retrospect, I must have felt like we were safely back in our normal life, because I believed Jason when he told me that I had no reason to worry when the police knocked on our door that night. It was three knocks, actually. The sound of the brass gargoyle against wood is full and aggressive, not to be ignored. I was doing my nighttime ritual early that night, right after dinner. It seemed to gain an extra step with each additional year of my life as a woman. Cleanser, toner, moisturizer, eye cream, neck serum, flossing, and brushing. I froze on instinct. I imagined the hand holding the knocker, wondered who the hand belonged to, wondered if they were alone. And then I heard Jason letting someone in. Did he even pause to ask who it was? Did he look through the peephole to see whether the fish-eyed face on the other side of the distorting lens appeared to be male or female? It was an argument we'd had before. That was back when he was still suggesting that I talk to someone about these lingering anxieties. I've told him it has nothing to do with the past. It's rational for me to be more afraid than he is. What is it like to live without fear? Jason has tried to help me be more like him, unafraid. Comforted by statistics showing that the odds of people like us becoming crime victims were at an all-time low. I try to help him understand that being like him is a luxury. Fear isn't rational, it's primal. And if he wanted to talk about statistics, he needed to look at two factors. The odds of something going wrong, yes, but also the severity of the harm should it in fact occur. In the real world, Jason might be the one who opened the door to a stranger, but I, as the only woman in the house, would be the one who truly suffered. So, when he let some person into our home, I stood on the landing, toothbrush still in hand, mouth full of foam, and listened with all my might. I couldn't make out the words, but the voice was female. Kneeling down, I saw two dark, fleshy calves. She was wearing black flats and a knee-length navy skirt. I walked to our bedroom window and looked down to the street. A generic, light-colored sedan was blocking our driveway. I knew immediately it was a police car. Jason? I called out. Is everything okay? I thought about Spencer in his room and hoped that he had his Beats headphones blasting as usual. Jason walked halfway up the stairs to speak to me. Unlike the house I grew up in this home, we do not yell from room to room, one of the mom rules. What's going on? I asked.
I guess there was an incident down the street.
He must have noticed me flinch at the word incident because he quickly clarified.
A fight of some sort. They're canvassing the neighborhood for witnesses. I told them we stayed in for dinner and hadn't seen anything. They're gone now.
He brushed my hair from the back of my neck and gave me a soft kiss. I smelled his soap and pert shampoo. I actually believed his explanation. But later that night, once we were in bed, I had that feeling in the pit of my stomach again. I couldn't sleep. I wrapped Jason's hand in mine and took a deep breath. He could tell I was anxious. He told me everything was fine. He asked me if I wanted to play the alphabet game.
We can do vacation,
he offered. He knows it's my favorite. I found myself smiling and started with A, Anguilla. He added beach. I followed with colada. The last word I remembered that night was iguana. I fell asleep with my mind in the Caribbean. But by the time I woke up the next morning, I realized what should have been obvious all along. Police don't block a family's driveway with an unmarked car on a fishing expedition for witnesses to a random assault. After Spencer left for school, I walked down to the payphone at the corner of 8th Street and University, called the 6th Precinct, and said I was wondering whether they'd identified the culprits involved in the assault on our block the previous night. I'm a mom. I want to make sure my kids are safe, I added for good measure. When they asked for my address, I gave them the apartment building 2 doors down from our carriage house.
You said this was last night?
The woman asked.
Yes, all the neighbors were talking about it. The police were going door to door a little before 8, looking for witnesses.
Nope. I'm not seeing anything in your area last night.
It sounds like someone on your block started a rumor.
People will do anything for attention these days.
I replaced the phone in the cradle, knowing for the first time in my marriage that Jason had lied to me, right to my face, as if it were nothing. 19. The young woman at the concierge desk was race ambiguous, with close-cropped bleached hair, deep-set eyes, and light brown skin. The black-collared shirt of her uniform was buttoned all the way up, but Corinne could see the curve of a tattoo peeking from the side of her neck. Corinne gave a quick flash of her badge and said she was there to see the head of security. She noticed an older couple at the reception counter next to her exchange a nervous look. Nothing to worry about, she assured them. Welcome to New York. The hotel in question was the W in Midtown. Carrie Lynch's company was based in Nassau County on Long Island, but she frequently stayed in the city overnight when she came in for meetings. In response to a subpoena, the hotel's general counsel had asked the security department to pull surveillance videos from the night Carrie said she was attacked by Jason Powell. Corinne was a big fan of surveillance cameras, but she could do without the private security guards who tended to come as part of the package. She was anticipating the inevitable questions. How long had she been on the job? What did she do before she was a cop? She told herself that it was the usual banter between wannabe cops and the real thing, but part of her always felt like she was being quizzed for another reason, as if it were her obligation to prove that this black woman deserved to have a detective's badge and gun instead of the polyester uniform of an unarmed security guard. She heard a booming voice behind her.
I think I recognize that Dunkin' Donut.
Her last name always had provided a convenient nickname for a police officer. Corinne turned to see a familiar face, slightly rounder and older than the last time she'd seen it. Shane Fletcher had been her sergeant when she first moved into the detective squad.
Well, oh my goodness. We are seriously dragging down the coolness factor in this lobby right here.
Tell me about it. The concierges tease me because they'd never seen a man wear pleated slacks before.
I hate to break it to you, but they probably make fun of you for using the word slacks, too. What are you doing working at a snazzy hotel?
Turns out retirement is boring as a bag of rocks. The wife's the one who figured out a hotel gig comes with major travel perks. Went to Vieques last month.
Heading to Indonesia in August.
Fletcher pulled a folded sheet of paper from his suit pocket.
I almost called you when I saw your name on the subpoena. Figured I'd surprise you instead. You ready to watch some movies?
The surveillance video was slightly better quality than average, but not the best, meaning that the two figures they were tracking were somewhere between gray blobs and a blurry home movie. Fletcher had already explained the process he'd used to narrow down the footage. He started by looking for people going in or out of the room registered to Carrie Lynch on April 10th, the night in question. Once he had eyes on Carrie, he looked for any other appearances between check-in and check-out by her or anyone else she was seen with. Usually Corinne wouldn't trust a private security guard to select which clip she needed to see, but Fletcher was a good cop. As it turned out, the only person Carrie was filmed with was a man Corinne recognized as Jason Powell. According to Fletcher, Carrie checked in alone shortly after 4:30 p.m., left alone shortly after 7:15, and then returned with Jason at 10:12 p.m. And go, he announced, hitting the play button. The two figures moved through the lobby, both in business attire, open collar and a sports coat for him, blouse, blazer, and knee-length skirt for her. After a shift in the camera perspective, they rode the elevator together side by, respectable distance by side. After another skip, they were in the hallway of the 11th floor. Nothing unusual yet, but Corinne flashed Fletcher a thumbs up. He had gone above and beyond the call of duty, editing the footage into one smooth scene. He nudged her, indicating that something good was about to happen. As Carrie fished what Corinne assumed to be a hotel key from her purse, Jason Powell placed the palm of his hand against her lower back and then followed her into the room as the door opened. Without prompting, Fletcher hit pause.
That was her back, right?
He asked.
Not her butt?
That's what I saw.
Fletcher raised his eyebrows. The gesture, combined with walking up to her hotel room for a private conversation, seemed more intimate than professional, but the moment moved quickly. It may have been a friendly after-you gesture.
So we're at 10:14 when they go inside, Fletcher said. Nothing more until this at 10:36.
22 minutes later. The light changed on the left side of the video. It was a door opening. Jason stepped out, walking backward. The sports coat was gone. He was still speaking to someone inside the hotel room. Carrie appeared in profile, barely past the threshold of the door, handing him his jacket. No, insisting that he take it. She seemed to be telling him to leave.
Pause?
Corinne asked. Carrie was still dressed, but her blazer was off. So were the heels she'd been wearing when they entered. Corinne nodded for Fletcher to hit play again. Jason was continuing to talk, and Carrie was still pushing the jacket toward him, finally tossing it toward him and shutting the door. Jason knocked on the door, paused, then knocked again. He hesitated and then looked side to side as if he were checking to make sure no one else was in the hallway. He ran his fingers through his hair and walked quickly to the elevator, pulling his jacket on as he moved. He pressed the button repeatedly, shifting his weight impatiently. Once in the elevator car, alone, he rested against the wall, leaning his head back.
Look, he's talking to himself, Fletcher whispered. Did you see it? His lips were moving.
The quality of the footage from the elevator was better than in the lobby and hallway. More light, closer perspective, probably better equipment. Fletcher skipped the footage back, and they both watched Jason's lips move again.
I watched it a couple times, but stopped to make sure I had enough time to get all the clips lined up. Best I got is whoop-de-doo.
Corinne chuckled. Only men in pleated slacks say whoop-de-doo. After several additional viewings, she had a theory. After two more, she was sure. She spoke the words aloud in sync with the silent movie. What did I do? Fletcher rewound, and this time they said it aloud together. Jason was saying, what did I do? Guilt, Corinne said, or panic.
Yeah, but about what?
Fletcher asked.
I know it was the guest's name on the subpoena, but I recognize the man. That intern's complaint is not the only one.
Corinne shook her head. Fletcher was the last person who'd speak out of turn about a case. He volunteered his first impression.
His hand on her back as they went in the room. She didn't come forward until now. He'll say it was consensual. He'll say the tiff at the door was because he didn't stay overnight, and what did I do? He was mad at himself for cheating on the wife.
Except that's not what he said when I asked him. When Corinne went to Powell's house the night before and asked about Carrie Lynch, he'd immediately said that she worked for one of his consulting clients. She asked him directly whether he'd had sexual contact with Carrie, and he denied it, accusing the NYPD of going on a witch hunt based on Rachel's accusation.
So now all you need is a DNA swap. Fletcher said. Not a bad case. Not a slam dunk, mind you, but I've seen worse.
Corinne had the footage on a thumb drive on her keychain when she called King from the car. The conversation was quick. Now that they had the video surveillance, plus Powell's denial of a relationship, he was ready to proceed, but AT&T had just confirmed that they'd be sending Powell's call log tomorrow. It was one more step to show a judge that they were being thorough. Once they had the AT&T phone records in hand, he'd ask for a warrant to collect a sample of Jason Powell's DNA. With a positive match, they'd have enough for charges. Corinne was halfway back to Harlem when her cell rang. Duncan, she said. It's Carrie Lynch. Hi, Carrie, I was about to call you. Corinne lied. One of her few complaints about sex cases was that victims tended to think of the case as theirs, as if they were private plaintiffs who employed the police and prosecutors. Please don't be mad. I should have called earlier.
Mad about what? Is everything okay?
Yeah, I guess. But Jason called me. Did you go to his house last night and ask him about me? Part of not reporting to victims as if they were her boss meant that Corinne did not inform Carrie of every step in the investigation. I needed to get a statement, she said. Well, he called me about it this morning. Corinne thought about the call logs that were supposed to be on their way to her from the cell phone company. Hopefully they'd be recent enough to capture whatever call Carrie was talking about. What did he say?
That he'd kill me if I told anyone what happened at the hotel that night. Please help me. He's not the man he pretends to be.
20. When I got to FSS's offices, Zach said Jason was out for a run.
Did he know you were coming in?
He asked. I wanted to tell him it was none of his business, that I could pop into my husband's office unannounced whenever I felt like it. And no, I hadn't called ahead. I was sick of Jason trying to protect me from the truth. I needed to ask him face to face why he had lied to me about the police coming to our house the night before. Instead, I said, oh, I had to return something at Barney's, so I figured I'd surprise him. I'll wait in his office. Two young men tried not to stare as I passed them in the hall. Interns. I recognized one as Wilson Stewart. I knew they'd be talking about me the second I was out of earshot. I didn't get up from my chair when he walked in. His t-shirt had the V-shaped ring of sweat down to his navel. He was thinner than usual. Why hadn't I noticed that earlier? He was still out of breath.
Hey, you. Zach said you were here.
He gave me a quick kiss on the cheek.
Sorry, I'm gross. It's still May and it feels like the middle of summer. Don't tell me global warming's a hoax.
Can you close the door? He did as I asked and then turned to face me.
Okay.
I had expected him to start explaining the second he saw me. He had to know why I was here. Just tell me the truth, Jason.
Babe, what are you...
Don't insult me. There was no assault on our block last night.
You checked?
No, you don't get to do that, Jason. You don't get to lie to your wife and then complain that I was smart enough to figure it out.
Jesus, can I at least take a shower first?
He flinched when the porcelain pencil cup that had been in front of me on the desk, the one that said world's best dad, hit the wall 2 feet to his left.
Damn it, Angela, you on my ass is the last thing I need right now.
Why were the police really there, Jason? It's about Rachel, isn't it? I thought again about those interns in the hallway. Did they know more than I did about what had happened between my husband and that girl in this office? If you don't tell me what you're hiding right now, I swear to God, I am picking up Spencer from school and taking him to my mother's house. Stop lying to me. Jason looked defeated as he walked to his bathroom and grabbed a small white towel. He dropped into the adjacent chair and placed his head in the towel, his elbows propped on his knees.
They asked me if I knew a woman named Carrie Lynch.
I was glad he wasn't looking up at me. I have a terrible poker face. I didn't want him to know that I was already familiar with the name. Why? He shook his head back and forth.
It was this same detective who called me about Rachel when I was in Philly. She said a new witness name had come up. She asked if I knew her. I explained that Carrie's the head of marketing for Oasis, that water company I told you about. I asked why she was asking. She said she wanted to know the nature of our relationship.
So what did she say?
He shrugged. That I know her from my consulting work.
I shook my head. Didn't you have a meeting with her a few days ago? He stared at me blankly.
How did you know that?
You told me, remember?
I didn't say her name.
It doesn't matter, Jason. You told me about the meeting when we were talking about that company. When the police came to the house, what exactly did they ask you?
They said Carrie's name had come up as a potential witness. They asked if I knew her and asked how I knew her.
He paused, and I knew there had to be more to the story.
And they asked whether there was any kind of sexual relationship between us.
And?
I told you, she works for a client. That's all, I swear.
Why didn't you refuse to answer like you did when the detective called you the first time?
I should have. But it's a lot easier to talk tough on the phone than when a cop's standing in the foyer making it sound like a straightforward question. I really didn't see the harm in answering. Rachel met Carrie once at FSS. I figured that's why they asked me about her. Like, maybe Rachel mentioned Carrie as a potential witness of something.
So why did you lie to me?
I didn't want you to worry. Nothing happened with me and Rachel. I was certain that whatever they were looking into with Carrie would all be sorted out before long.
But what if it's not about Rachel, Jason? What if this woman, Carrie, is making accusations too? He shook his head.
She wouldn't.
Rachel did, I snapped. Why wouldn't this woman? I saw a glimpse of concern cross his face.
I called her this morning and asked her.
What? Jason, that's crazy. You should have called your lawyer.
We work together. I talked to her regularly. I asked her if the police had contacted her.
And?
She said no and then had to run into a meeting. The call was probably less than a minute.
She could be lying, Jason. Just from watching TV, I couldn't imagine the police coming to our house to ask about a relationship with this woman unless they'd spoken to her first. You said there's a problem at the company, the kickbacks or whatever? Could it be related to that?
Maybe.
His gaze drifted into the distance, seeing the possibility for the first time.
Remember how I told you that I'd been trying to get one of the employees to help me prove my suspicions?
I nodded.
That was Carrie. When I told her my concerns, I could tell she knew more than she was letting on. She finally admitted that she had found internal documents that could prove their wrongdoing, but she was too scared to give me the evidence. I was trying to convince her to give them to me.
His voice trailed off. Why is that your job, Jason? Couldn't you have called the police or something?
More like the FBI or State Department. But my investors would be fucked, and so would my reputation. I'd go from being Mr. Socially Responsible to a supporter of warlords. But if I had actual proof, not merely insinuation, if I were a whistleblower, I'd be protected. And I could probably recoup my investors' funds, too.
And that's why you met with Carrie this week?
I've been trying to convince her for weeks. I told her she'd be protective if she helped me expose Oasis. But then Rachel's ridiculous complaint hit the news. My guess is that Carrie changed her mind and told her bosses what I was up to instead. I could be completely screwed.
A few minutes ago, he had been convinced this was nothing to worry about. Now, my husband was panicking. What is it? I asked.
The last time I met with her, she was supposed to give me documents. She wanted to meet somewhere private.
I felt my eyes widen.
I went to her house in Port Washington. Fuck, no one else was there. She can make up whatever she wants, and I can't prove a thing.
When I got home, Spencer was lying on the sofa looking at something on his phone. He tucked it under his side when I walked through the door. Stepping toward him, I could see that he'd turned off the screen. So what was that? I remembered a few boys eagerly passing around a magazine when I was a couple of years older than Spencer, scanning the school hallways to make sure no teachers were watching before covertly handling the transfer. Into the next backpack, the magazine went. Trisha and I concocted a plan to get a glimpse at what we were missing. While Teddy Dunnigan was working on his homework at lunch, Trisha undid an extra button on her blouse and leaned over to ask if he knew the math assignment for sixth hour. While he ogled her, I slipped my hand into the open backpack on the floor behind him and made off with our bounty. By that time, I had seen plenty of R-rated movies and a couple of Playboys. I'd even let Bill McElroy cop a feel under my shirt. But I hadn't seen or heard of or even imagined the kind of things depicted in the photographs in that magazine. Those pictures would be tame compared to the videos that were now prevalent online. I had read articles about the damage that pornography does, especially to kids, boys in particular. We supposedly had filters to keep Spencer from looking at that stuff, but I had no idea how well they worked, especially for a kid as smart as my son. Nothing, he said a little too quickly. Spencer, I started to reach for his phone, but he snatched it first. Not cool, kid. He relented and handed over his device. His browser was open to a blog called The Pink Spot. I had never heard of it. The photo at the top of the post was the one making the rounds, Rachel's blurred face nuzzling up to Wilson Stewart. Someone had marked the photo with a red no-smoking insignia. I skimmed the post quickly enough to gather that the author was complaining about the victimization of the brave woman who had stepped forward to question Jason Powell's white male privilege. I hadn't had a chance yet to check that day's internet activity. Now it's a race thing? I asked, immediately feeling guilty for speaking to Spencer about this. I was supposed to be protecting him. It's just one blogger. Look at the comments, he said, not meeting my eyes. There were 24 so far, not many compared to a mainstream website, but more than a few. I finally found the one Spencer was talking about. His wife grew up four blocks from me. Thinks she's hot shit. Always goes to the fanciest restaurants when she visits to make sure we know she made it. Truth is, she ran away in high school for 3 years and came home after she got knocked up. Only thing she has going for her is this guy. If he's guilty, I say karma, baby. I recognized the name of the commenter, Deb Kunitz, as a girl 2 years behind me in school. Another commenter had a follow-up question. I would have assumed his wife was a fellow academic or maybe in politics. Does this add another layer to the story? Maybe he can't handle an intellectual equal? A second reply followed. Sounds like an